You would expect the Bible would cover that because it is a book that deals with practical matters. 2 Peter 1:3, God has given unto us all things that pertain to life and godliness. So everything that pertains to life and godliness is found somewhere in the Word of God. Those are practical matters. We also know that God is interested in our worship, especially in how it develops our spirituality and how it shows our devotion to Him. 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 would tie in with that, and John 4:23 and 24. So let's read this passage. There really are two aspects to 1 Corinthians 16:1-4. The first one has to do with Paul's special missionary relief effort for the poor saints in Jerusalem. He was not in Jerusalem, but he was going to Jerusalem. And he knew of the condition of the Christians who were there. They were in great need. And so as he traveled from city to city, church to church, he was making a collection so that when he got to Jerusalem, he would be able to present it to them to relieve their difficulties. And so he's writing to the Corinthian church ahead of time before he gets there on his journey and saying, I'm going to be coming, I'm going to be taking a collection. I'd like for you to make an offering to them, and you can send someone with me. And if it's convenient, I will go with him to Jerusalem to see that they get it. And then the other aspect is how he was going to see that they collected that bounty was through the regular offering in their worship service. So you see both aspects of it. There was a relief effort, but there also was underlying it his instruction about how to take the contribution on a weekly basis, a part of which would be used in this case for the special offering that would be made for those poor Christians. So let's read 1 Corinthians 16:1-4. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches in Galatia, even so do ye. The main idea in that verse is that the Bible does give us instruction about how to make the contribution. It's disappointing in our generation and in previous ones that many religious groups have set aside the biblical plan for supporting the works of the church. I should say have supplemented, because as far as I know, all religious groups still collect as a part of the worship service an offering for the poor or for evangelism or whatever the purpose might be. But they supplement it with bake sales or car washes or raffles, any number of different ideas. As far as I can tell in the New Testament, the work of the church was always supported by the free will offerings of the members, without exception. And so there is no authority for those kinds of additional supplemental cases. Now notice in this verse, the key idea is, I have given order to the churches. So he was teaching the church in Corinth the same thing that he had taught the other churches in Galatia, so that all the churches were understanding and believing and practicing the same doctrine inspired by God through the Apostle Paul, and he was reiterating what they knew through the Spirit and through their teachers. So he had given order. Order is a command to be obeyed. Now verse 2. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. And when I come, whosoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. And if it be meet that I go also, they shall go with me. Now let's talk about the aspect of the collecting for Jerusalem first, and then we'll go into the contribution on a regular basis. Let's go over to the book of Acts and start with chapter 2 and try to figure out why they were in this need. Acts chapter 2, we'll begin in verse the latter part, about verse 44. There seem to have been two reasons why, two possibilities. The first one has to do with the beginning of the church. You remember that when the church began, it was a Jewish holiday of Pentecost, and many of them had remained in Jerusalem after that the day of Pentecost, the week of celebration was ended, because they had learned of Christ and His sacrifice. They had become Christians, so they did not want to immediately go back home to their places of normal abode. There were 14 nations mentioned in the first part of Acts chapter 2. So it didn't take too long, I suppose, before their funds ran out. They intended to stay for a week. They stayed for a month. Some of them may have even stayed on for years after that. And so in the latter part of Acts chapter 2, we see that the Christians who had money or perhaps who had jobs who lived there were helping to support the others. That's in verse, all that believed in verse 44 were together and had all things common. That is, they were sharing with one another. If one had plenty of food, he shared with others. Or one had some extra money to pay for lodging, then he would share with the other. And all the people saw... let's skip to the next chapter, verse 45. And sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men as every man had need. Now we see that immediately upon the beginning of the church. But look at chapter 4. This continued, verses 33 to 35. And with great power gave the apostles witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold and laid them down at the apostles' feet and distributed them, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. Now this is not communism. We might, in an aside, make a comment about that. This is not giving everything that you possess to a government then to redistribute to others. This is Christian charity, where you're having someone who is selling property or making a donation to the local congregation who is sharing in a benevolent capacity to those in their number who have a need that these monies can meet. So that's one idea, that it could be that he was collecting money because this had continued even down to the time when Paul was writing to the Corinthians, the third missionary journey. But it seems more likely that it ties in with Acts chapter 11, that there was a great famine in the land and that people did not have means to support themselves because their crops weren't coming in. And of course, not only that sector of the economy was hurt because their economy was agriculturally based. Therefore, if the farmers were hurting, then that hurt all the other merchants and all the other jobs. So you had a famine. So when you had a famine, you ended up having difficult economy for all people. Look at the last part of chapter 11, beginning in verse 27. And in those days came prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch, and there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be great dearth throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. Now 29, then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea, which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. So here you have the reason for it. There were people who were hurting, and the other Christians, even though they were at a great distance from them, felt compassion, felt the need to help them. That's just like today. You see, if you have a brother or sister who may live out of state or out of the country, if you heard that they were hurting, then you certainly would dig deep and give what you could to meet the need that they have. And we even see that, even feel that for strangers. If you have a situation like an earthquake or a tsunami or some other natural disaster that hits our country or somewhere else, often you will have relief efforts by the local congregation who will say, well, you know, this church in this particular area is going to be helping to distribute funds to the needy people in their community, and we're going to take up a special collection this next Sunday. And people will give, and then it'll be sent and distributed in the same way that we see it happening here. Now, Paul had his reasons for this, for collecting the money. Let's go to Acts chapter 15. I'll mention three or four possibilities of why Paul is spearheading this effort. He was a great missionary, of course, and he had all that responsibility. But now he's taking time for the poor. He's taking time also to raise money to help poor people. So why would he do this? Well, let's think about four reasons. Number one, the Gentiles owed a debt to the Jews because they were the ones who had made it possible for them to receive the gospel. You remember that the church began in Jerusalem. The missionaries were first sent out from that location, and now the gospel had reached all the way to Corinth, and other places in that part of the world. So really, they were Christians because of the efforts of those of their brethren way back over in Jerusalem. So they owed them a debt in the same way that Paul talks about in Romans 1, 15 and 16, and Romans 15, 25 to 26. Now, at the Jerusalem conference, which is Acts chapter 15, a second reason that Paul was willing to do this and happy to do it is because that when he met in Jerusalem, you remember there was a problem in the early church that had to do with circumcision. The Jews believed that should be a part of Christianity, that no one could be right with God unless he had been circumcised, because they had been brought up in that culture throughout the Old Testament period, 1,500 years. But God left that out of the New Testament covenant. Not to say it's wrong to circumcise a child in this generation for health reasons, but there's no religious reason to do it. In the Old Testament, there was a religious reason to do it. So that was very difficult for Jewish Christians to accept, because that had always been the dividing line, one of the dividing lines between Jews and Gentiles. So there's this problem in the church. It didn't just have to do with that, but it had to do with that primarily. And there was this conflict between Jews and Gentiles in the early church. So there's a conference in Jerusalem where the elders and the apostles meet and they have discussions about it. And they come to a conclusion that God does not expect circumcision to be bound upon Gentiles, and that Jewish Christians are to accept them on the same basis as they would accept other Jews who had been converted to Christ. And in the summation of this, let's find down in verse 28 and 29. "For it seemed good to the Holy Ghost and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things, that you abstain from meats offered to idols, and from blood, and from things strangled, and from fornication." So all those things were bound where circumcision wasn't. "From which if you keep yourselves, ye shall do well." Drop down then to verse... Well, look at Galatians 2:10. I don't see it in Romans 15. It is there. Someone else may find it. But when Paul is reiterating this event, he's giving the chronology of his own life in Galatians 2. And that's the passage I wrote down. Verse 10, he's talking about this very event in Acts chapter 15. And what had been given and what instruction had been given to him, they had extended to he and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. That is, the Jewish Christians and the Jerusalem church was fully supportive of Paul's missionary efforts as he went out, right hands of fellowship. But this is what they said to him. That's in verse 9, "that we should go to the heathen and they into the circumcision." So they decided to divide up their efforts. Peter primarily apostle to the Jews, and they would continue to work in Jerusalem and in other areas with those who had been prepared by the law to accept Jesus as the Christ. And Paul would spearhead the efforts of carrying the gospel to the rest of the world. So that was a good plan. They both had a special interest in that. Then verse 10, "only that we should do what?" Galatians 2 verse 10. "Remember the poor." When they left Jerusalem, Paul had a special admonition from the Jews. Maybe it did relate to the fact that they had these poor Christians that were there who needed, maybe there was a special need otherwise. But certainly Paul said that, the last part, "the same which I also was forward to do," he said, "that was not a problem for me. I wanted to do that anyway, so I readily agreed." So now Paul is following through with that promise that he would remember the poor. In his evangelistic zeal, he did not forget benevolence. He did not overlook those who were hurting physically just because he was trying to save them spiritually. So that ties in with Paul's decision to gather these funds and take them back to Jerusalem, because he had promised to do that. Then number three, and perhaps Paul's greatest reason for doing it, was that he wanted to build a bridge between the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians. Of course, Paul had grown up in Judaism. He was a Pharisee of the Pharisees, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. So he had a special love in his heart for his own nation. Romans chapters 9 and 10, he talks extensively about that. But he also had a special place in his heart for all these Gentile Christians that he had led to Christ. And so there was this, as we've mentioned, this division, barrier between the groups. And Paul is thinking, this is a wonderful way for the Gentiles and the Jews to have better relations with each other. How are the Jews going to feel toward the Gentiles if Paul and other representatives come to Jerusalem and they pull out all this money that they have collected and said, here, we want to help. We heard that you're hurting. Well, that's going to make those Jews in Jerusalem feel warmly toward the Gentiles in distant lands. It's going to help build a bridge between those two groups that had had some difficulty accepting one another. And the fourth reason why this is collected is because it's a part of the gospel. Galatians 6, verse 10, we are to help those who are in need, especially those who are of the household of faith. So, you can't be a Christian unless you're willing to help others. Paul knew of the need, and he was willing to not only teach that we should help, but also to practice what he was preaching. All right, any thoughts about the missionary relief effort? That's all we'll say about that. Now let's talk about the regular contribution that Paul used to get that special relief effort, which is the broader teaching in 1 Corinthians 16. Sometimes the best way to approach a Bible subject is just to ask those trusty questions, who, what, when, where, how. If you can answer those questions about just about any subject, then you'll have a pretty good summary of what the Bible teaches about that subject. So a simple lesson, we'll just go through those basic questions. First, let's talk about the when. I don't know if you mark in your Bible, and I would encourage you to mark intelligently to make notes. I've found through the years that I don't remember as much as I wish I did about studies that I did in the past, even sermons that I may have preached several times. But when I'm preaching or preparing to preach, if I've made notes in my Bible, then that's very helpful. I can tie that in to the new things that I'm learning so that you have a good tool to remember what this verse means or how it connects to another verse. And so don't mark just without thinking about it, but write few words and abbreviations that you will remember. And you could do that here with verse 2. The first one is the when. If you wanted to put quotation marks around upon the first day of the week and draw a little line to the side and put when, because that gives us the instruction as to how God wants us to take the offering. He wants us to do it on Sunday. Let's think about three ideas about that. The first one is our giving is to be done on Sunday, the first day of the week. Let's explore a little bit about that. Why would Paul even mention it if he did not intend for it to be a part of the worship? Because that's the day that they met for worship. You remember that in Acts 20, verse 7, that was the day that they met to take the Lord's Supper. And that goes back to that to the fact that the church began on a Sunday. Do you know how to show someone who believes in worshiping on the Sabbath how that the New Testament worship is to be done on the Lord's Day? Well, let me show you real quick. Go back to Acts chapter 2. What was the Jewish feast day that was going on when the church began? Pentecost. All right? And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Did you know that the Jewish day of Pentecost always came on Sunday? It had for 1,500 years. Now that was unusual because most of the Jewish holidays were on what day? Sabbath day. Saturday, seventh day of the week. Why did God choose the seventh day for the Jewish day of worship? Anybody? The day of rest. Genesis 2:1. That's the day when God rested from creating the world. That's the reason He chose that day. He did not initially choose it all the way back at the beginning. No, that day was not sanctified until the law of Moses. But that's why it was chosen under the law of Moses, because God rested on that day. He wanted them to rest on that day. But in the New Testament, the day of worship changed. And that's one of the evidences that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Here you have a group of people, a nation who have been worshiping on one day of the week, and all of a sudden, they change and start worshiping on Sunday. What would explain that change? Only the resurrection of Jesus is an adequate one. We'll go back to Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 15, and we can see that day of Pentecost always came You counted seven Sabbaths after the Passover. So Passover is on Saturday. So 7 weeks later would be Saturday. And then the morning after, which would be Sunday, you are to have the next feast, the Feast of Pentecost, Feast of Weeks. Leviticus 23:15, "And you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheave or the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall you complete, even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath shall you number 50 days, and you shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord." So there's the background of the day of Pentecost. It was called Pentecost by the New Testament time, Feast of Weeks in the Old Testament. So there you have, and so you should write in your Bible beside Acts 2 verse 1, Leviticus 23, 15 and 16, which will show what day Pentecost always came on. So there we have first the reason for it. It was the day when the church was established. It also was the day when Jesus was resurrected, of course, Matthew 28, 1 through 6. Early on the first day of the week, they found the tomb to be empty. That's why they worshiped on the first day of the week. And that's why Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 16, "Upon the first day of the week, let each one of you lay by him in store." It was the day of worship. So our giving ought to be, number one, on the Lord's day. It ought to be given on Sunday. And that does not mean that if there is a need during the week that we cannot help someone on, say, a Tuesday. But it does mean that we should always make our contribution as a part of our worship on the Lord's day, on Sunday. If Paul had been coming through Corinth on a Tuesday and he mentioned to someone, "I'm taking up some money for the poor saints in Jerusalem," and they said, "Well, here, let me help." And Paul would not have said, "No, you can't help. You can't help because it's a Tuesday." He would have let them contribute to it, but that would have been in addition to their usual. What about that your usual offering on Sunday? What about the parable of the Good Samaritan? If we find someone on the side of the road who's in need, we don't say, "Well, I would help you, but it's not the Lord's day." No, we have to help. But he's saying that our normal, regular contribution is to be made as a part of the worship on the Lord's day. And you can put in your notes on that point if you want. Philippians 4, 15 and 16, a passage we'll look at a little bit later today, that says that churches collected the money and supported Paul. That's the best way to do it today as it was then, because there's more accountability and the Lord receives greater glory for members of the church to contribute and then support a missionary. There's great accountability because it comes into the church funds and the elders are responsible for it, and then they can better keep up with where the money's going. They may send it to another eldership that's over that particular mission work. But individuals do support. Yes, just a moment. Let me go ahead and tie in the second one so I don't forget. 2 Timothy 1, 16 through 18, individuals can also support good works. 2 Timothy 1, 16 through 18. Yes. Yes, she has asked, what about the last part of verse 2, which I hope to get to today, but I'll go ahead and touch on it in case I don't. What Paul is saying is, when he comes to collect this money on the way to Jerusalem, that he doesn't want there to be them trying to come up with it at the last moment to give him their contribution, that they will be more successful in giving a little bit all along until he gets there, and then they'll be able to give from their collection or their bounty to him. I think the same thing is true in an applied sense to our work in the kingdom today. It may be that we are going to support a work that's coming up, like I think it's in our plan of work again to give a certain dollar goal to the Child Haven. It may be that we could come up with something if we just, on that particular week, said, "I'm going to write a check for X number of dollars." But most of us probably, if we saved up a little bit along each week, we would be able to give more than if we just did whatever we had handy if we hadn't planned for it ahead of time. Someone else may have something you'd like to add to that. The first point is our giving is to be done on Sunday. The second point is on the who, or rather the when, Our giving is to be done every Sunday. this is not in the English version, but the little word katas, K-A-T-A, is in the Greek here, and it means every. It doesn't mean that we can give on Sundays whenever we want to give on Sundays, but it means that we should give every Sunday that we have prospered. We should make a contribution to the Lord's work. Let's look at three places where this same word is used. Go to Luke chapter 2, verse 41. When are we to give? We're to give on Sunday. It's a part of our worship. When are we to give? We are to give on every Sunday, not skipping any Sundays. Because if we have prospered that week, we are to give that week. Luke 2, verse 41, the same idea of this consecutive. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year. Now that's a year frequency instead of a weekly frequency, but the same idea is there. That every time that feast day came, they went to Jerusalem. Every time the first day of the week comes, we are to make a contribution to the Lord. Now, there are two reasons why we should be careful that we do not skip any weeks in making our contribution. The first one is, and that's fairly easy to do if, for instance, we're sick and we miss a Lord's Day, or if we're traveling. It might be easy to say, well, you know, I don't know this congregation very well, or this congregation, I'm not a part of this congregation, so I'm just going to give a smaller amount. But there are two reasons why we should make sure that we always give on Lord's Day, and it's best to give to the local congregation where you're a member and where you're part of the plan of work. You could either leave it before you leave, or if you're sick, you could send it with a spouse or a child or a parent. Someone who could put it in the plate for you, or you could make it up when the next service you're able to be in. But two reasons. Number one, whose money is that? Whose money is it? It's God's money. If I keep God's money, what have I done? I have stolen God's money. I don't want to rob anybody, but I especially don't want to rob God. I mean, He's going to know about it, for one thing, and He's also in a position to judge us in the end, so I do not want to rob God. Look at Malachi chapter 3 and see that that very terminology is used as it related to the Old Testament worshiper and his giving. Malachi 3, they're surprised when God says that you've robbed me, but let's read how God's prophet makes that very point. Malachi 3, verse 7, even from the days of your fathers you are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. So what ordinances had they not kept? Well, keep reading. But ye say, wherein shall we return? What are we not doing? Now, verse 8. Will a man rob God? Well, that's a good question. Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed you? Was the And the answer, in tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. So, first reason I don't want to fail to give, if I receive 52 paychecks in a year, how many contributions should I make? 52. And if I do 51 because I was sick one Sunday, or I do 49 because I was out of town two other Sundays during the year, then I have robbed God of whatever that contribution would have been if I had been in the worship. So that's one reason. A second reason, let me comment before I leave the robbing, and I'll come back to that. There are actually three that are being robbed if I don't give as I'm supposed to. One is robbing God. Two is I'm robbing other Christians, because somebody else is going to have to support the work of the church. If I don't bear my part, someone else will have to bear it. So I am actually freeloading on the church, on the backs of other Christians if I don't bear my fair share. And then number three, I'm robbing myself of the blessings that I receive from giving. What is it that Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive, Acts 20:35. So I'm robbing myself. There's a greater blessing in giving it than there is in keeping it. And then thought about this, just to make this practical. Sometimes we give principles, and that's good, but a lot of times it's better if you actually make it more practical so people can say, oh, I see how that applies now. So I came across these three ways that we might rob God. One is what we just talked about, if we were out of town or sick and we did not make up our contribution. But what about this one? If we are still giving what we did before our last raise, and if we were properly giving then, we cannot now be giving according to our prosperity. So when we get a raise, God gets a raise. Number two, we must be careful not to slack off during crunch times. For instance, Christmas time, we have all these gifts that we want to give our children, our parents, or all these gifts that we may feel we need to give to extended relatives or friends, that they're getting me something, I've got to get them something. But what we can do is put ourselves in such a bind financially that we say, I can't have anything to give today. And what has happened if I do that? I've spent God's money on myself or on my kids. Don't rob God during Christmas time. What about during tax time? Here we get our taxes back and, I got to pay in this year. I'm not getting anything back. How am I going to come up with this X number of dollars? Well, I won't be able to give for a few weeks till I get this made up. Well, what have I done? I've stolen from God to pay the government. What about this one? It's vacation time. You know, we want to stay an extra day. We didn't really budget for this. Well, I won't be able to, you know, if we don't give next Sunday, we'll have enough to stay this. What about this one? College, this applies to us, the college tuition. Oh boy, I got to pay that bill to the college or school clothes for the kids. Well, I got to cut back somewhere. Where can I cut back to make up? Well, the last thing we ought to cut back is our contribution to the Lord instead of something else. So those are, and really when you think about that, let's just put it on a calendar. Let's say that I stop giving for a little while around tax season, so that's April. And then when I go on vacation in July, I don't give a few weeks there to make up for that. And then when it gets the fall and kids are going back to school, I can't give right then because of school clothes and tuition. And then Christmas time, you know, December and January, I'm trying to make up for that. What have I done? See, I've pretty much limited God the whole year as I've cut back on that in order to do something else. So that's another way we might rob God. And then a third way is if we give in to materialism and purchase a big ticket item such as a new house, car, or boat, and then we get ourselves in a bind and say, oh, I don't know how I'm going to make all these ends meet. Got to make this extra payment. Well, I guess I just won't be able to give to the Lord, or I'll cut back on my contribution. I read someone who said a family gets into $1,000 worth of clothes on Sunday, walks out of a $150,000 house, gets into a $35,000 automobile, drives to the church building, and says, I don't have anything to give to the Lord. You know, have to be careful, because that's the very thing that it's easy to do, especially as we're talking about on Wednesday nights, you know, trying to catch up to where our parents were after, you know, 30 years of marriage, and we want to get there in the first year of our marriage, and so we borrow a lot of money in order to have new this and new that and big this and big that, and then the church ends up suffering, not just for a little while, but sometimes, you know, that's a 30-year note I signed on that house. So 30 years later, that's going to put, if that bill continues to be a problem financially, then that's going to hinder me for a long time. And the second reason that we should make 52 contributions if we receive 52 paychecks is the expenses of the Lord's church go on even if I'm not there. It's a great blessing to be a part of a thriving congregation, but have you thought about how we benefit from that? I mean, our children in the Bible classes, someone's buying the literature that those children are using. Someone's built the room where they're meeting. Here the congregation has an active plant program of work that's helping me to grow spiritually. Speakers are coming in, teaching on topics, and here, so on and so forth. You understand? So there's a blessing that comes to me, and I should bear my part of that work. And those blessings or those expenses will go on even if I'm not there one particular Sunday. That's true. And I wanted to talk about that. Maybe get your opinion on this. We get paid every 2 weeks. I don't know how you get. Some farmers, for instance, get paid. Most of their money will come in the fall when they harvest. Some others get paid once a month. I don't know how teachers get paid. So how would you give in that case? I think that there really are two answers to that. I'll give you my opinion, and you may have another one that's different, and that'd be fine. But I thought about this a good bit yesterday, and I'm glad you brought this up, Haskell. I think it has to do with, I think the best case is, like in our case, we get paid every other week. We just divide it in half and give the check, every first day of the week. So we have a contribution to make. But if I were a farmer, I thought about that, and I'm making most of my money at one time of the year, let's say in the fall, I might do better to give most of my contribution right then, because I'm liable to spend that between there and next year, and toward the end of the year, I don't have God's money anymore. So, but there's another side of that too that I think plays into this. When I go preach in other congregations on Sunday, we give here because this is the plan of work that we're supporting. But I don't want to pass that plate down the aisle when I'm preaching for this church over in Mississippi, and those boys and girls sitting around saying, "Well, that preacher didn't even give anything." So, and I want my boys and girls to understand that we give every first day of the week. So even when I'm there, I'll put something in the plate. It doesn't have to be. It's not what we give here. It's just a small amount. But it's something so that our boys and girls, when they see, they gave something, and the others won't have to wonder, does he support the work of the church? So I think maybe a combination, probably the best, is just to divide it and give it. That's how you made the money, even though it was only paid on a month or 2 weeks or a year. But in some cases, if you think that you may not have the money to give later, give the bulk of it, and then you'll have something to give. Maybe give a smaller amount. Yes. That's a good, and I thought about that. It says, as you've been prospered. Some weeks you don't prosper. Let's just say you were changing jobs and there was a week between. You didn't get a paycheck. I think I would make a token offering that week just for the same reason I just mentioned. But it would not be the normal amount because you're not prospered that week. I think that's a good point. And some people are only extended, looking for jobs for an extended period. And that's why it says, as you've been prospered. Yes. That's true. That's right. Like First Samuel 16:7, the Lord knows our hearts. He knows what we intend to do. Somebody else. Our time's up, but we'll take one more comment. That's true. And I've thought about that. We'll talk about that more later today. But his comment is that God promised to take care of us if we put him first. There really are two key issues to this subject. One is trust, and that's what you're touching on, and the other is stewardship. Those are the two key points here, really, trust and stewardship. All right, thanks for your comment. Let's be dismissed in a prayer. Our Father,